Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Toyota not moving forward. You might say there are problems under the hood.
If anybody owns one of these vehicles, stop driving it.
We've had some complaints about the electronics.
What I said in there was obviously a misstatement. What I meant to say,
you need to get on this. You got a problem.
A recall, a series of statements from the Secretary of Transportation, and the largest car company in the world is reeling. Sales down, wounded brand, expensive fix.
You got a problem.
Unscheduled maintenance at Toyota HQ.
I love what you do for me, Toyota.
Toyota, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It is Thursday, February 4th, and The Takeaway is wondering if there is a sort of corporate point of no return here for Toyota as this develops so rapidly.
I don't know. I mean, I imagine that a lot of people have said that about a lot of companies, and the years go by, and it does eventually fade away, but I'm sure Toyota is hoping that passes quickly. Let's get to the top stories we're following this morning. New problems for the automaker this morning, Toyota. A few hours ago, the company announced design problems with the anti-lock brake system in the new Prius. This after nearly 140 complaints in the U.S., mostly from drivers who say they temporarily lost brake power after driving over a pothole or ice. As for the recall yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said investigators are looking at more than just gas pedals in Toyotas.
It's up to us to tell them if we think that their solution is not correct, and now we'll be doing investigations and studying the electronic part of it.
Toyota stock has plummeted 22% since the recall was announced.
Since this is such a rapidly developing story, we're joined once again by Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. We've got good news and bad news from Toyota this morning, and it seems like it almost cancels out. Paul?
Well, the short-term good news is that they earned, $1.2 billion adjusted for the weak dollar during the most recent quarter. The bad news is that they could take a bath going forward, not just from the recalls we've already heard, but now it appears their halo cars we have been reporting for more than a month was, in fact, defective. The Prius had a problem. It appears Toyota knew about it and didn't tell anybody.
Well, Paul Eisenstein, thanks so much. A $1.7 billion profit potentially erased by the problems we're going to explore a little bit later on the program. Celeste?
President Obama tried to rally his party at a Democratic retreat yesterday.
So as we think about moving forward, I hope we don't lose sight of why we're here. We've got to finish the job on health care.
New meaning added to that this morning. A new report shows health care spending grew to a record 17% of the U.S. economy last year. That's the biggest one-year jump on record. Overall, almost $2.5 trillion federal dollars were spent on health care last year. And the report says in 2 years, federal and state programs will pay for slightly more than half of all health care in the U.S.
Two key pieces of legislation to talk about this morning. First, a bipartisan Senate bill introduced today will give business tax breaks for hiring unemployed workers. And the House will vote on whether to raise the cap on federal borrowing to $14 trillion.
Moving overseas, intelligence officials now say the leader of the Pakistani Taliban was killed in a missile attack last month. He's responsible for a wave of suicide bombings, including the attack on the CIA base. And in Haiti, 10 missionaries facing charges for trying to leave the country with undocumented children will appear before a prosecutor today. The prosecutor will decide whether to press charges. The parents say they were promised education and housing for their children. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,270. The S&P opens at 1,097. The NASDAQ at 2190. So Google, how do we use it? Just as a search engine? And while we're using it all those times per day, what's it doing to our brains? We're going to talk about today during their tech segment.
And your assignment this morning, you know, the Tea Party convention is kicking off in Nebraska. They hope to start a third political party, but if you were going to start a political party, give us your platform, all right? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, a slogan for your political party. Start one today at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Toyota's problems.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Toyota, biggest car company in the world, certainly one of the most successful brands in the world, which is why the slogans over the years of Toyota's advertising campaigns come quickly to mind. Moving Forward, their current one. But they all have an ironic twist right now. You asked for it. You got it. Toyota, what a feeling. Driving excitement.
Right.
All of these very well-known slogans now add to the brand problems that are associated with Toyota's mechanical problems. There were the accelerator pedals. Paul Eisenstein just referred to confirmation that there are perhaps design problems with Prius brakes. Toyota officials estimated the total cost of the global recall that they're currently in the middle of, $2 billion, the loss of 100,000 vehicles in sales in the United States and Europe. All this has erased a profit reported today of $1.7 billion. We want to explore the sort of brand problems going forward for this very venerable and troubled company with Jeffrey Leiker, who's a professor at the University of Michigan's College of Engineering and co-author of The Toyota Way. And we should remind people that all the problems referred to in the recall, you have a minuscule chance of experiencing. But when you're as big as Toyota, they are statistically significant. And Ken Benziger joins us. He's a reporter at the Los Angeles Times, co-author of a series of investigative reports on Toyota's runaway cases and some other safety issues. Jeffrey and Ken, good morning.
Good morning.
Ken, let's begin with you. Is there a sense, and I think some of your reporting suggests that that may be the case, that what we've already seen is the tip of something maybe a little bit bigger?
There are a lot of issues out there that haven't answered specifically about the runaway acceleration issue or what some call unintended or sudden acceleration. And there's some questions that have to be answered about how long Toyota has known about this and how they've responded to it. Because it could go back as far at least to 2001, maybe 1999. There's also bigger questions about how Toyota handles safety questions in general, even in systems that have nothing to do with this.
And this is something that Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood expressed explicitly yesterday, saying that Toyota needed to be pressured to enter this recall. He had this advice yesterday.
My advice is, if anybody owns one of these vehicles, stop driving it, take it to the Toyota dealer, because they believe they have the fix for it.
Of course, then he backed off from that. But the continuing statements from the Transportation Secretary can't make people at Toyota HQ happy. Jeffrey Leiker, professor at the University of Michigan, what is a company to do in this media onslaught?
Well, the first thing they have to do is fix the problem. And that's what they're focusing on is about 4 or 5 million cars to recall, and that physically means getting them in, getting the part in. And that's going to take precedence over talking to the media. I'm not sure what Ray LaHood was trying to accomplish by creating an international panic of people just driving their cars to Toyota and dumping them on the lot. But when people say strange things like that, dangerous things like that, Toyota can't really respond confrontationally to the federal government. So they simply say, thank you for your comment. We think you probably meant this. The issue of...
Let's take a look at that, Jeffrey. I mean, does Ray LaHood, rightly or wrongly, suddenly precipitate a crisis that is not unlike the unsafe at any speed problem that the Corvair had when Ralph Nader went after it? Of course, the personal injury lawsuit that derailed the Ford Pinto. Do these even come close to the category here?
Well, I think an exploding gas tank is just different than a sticky pedal that is slow to return, or carpets that shouldn't be in the car to begin with unattached down. But there's two issues. One is, could Toyota have come forward sooner? Could they have solved the problem sooner? And another is, now, at this point, we know it's a minuscule problem. We know that it doesn't occur in new cars. We know that, at least the issue of the sticky pedal, we know that you can, in almost all cases, use the brake and stop the car. Why would you want millions of people driving their car? If it's unsafe, leave it in your driveway. Why do you want them dumping it at a Toyota dealer? And just creating a mess, logistics mess for everybody. That doesn't make any sense.
Jeffrey Leichert's a professor at the University of Michigan's College of Engineering. He's co-author of The Toyota Way. Ken Benziger, LA Times reporter, You know, in your investigative reports on Toyota, is some of what you've reported the consequence of being so big and having to operate in so many countries where so much is subcontracted out, often as a condition of even doing business in those countries, that if you get too big, you can't possibly succeed? Bigness is failure in this business.
Well, I want to respond to that, but first I wanted to clear up a few things that Mr. Leiker suggested. I think we've kind of moved beyond the idea that it's only a pedal or a floor mat issue. One of the reasons that LaHood is talking about this is he's demanding that Toyota discuss other potential causes for this problem. And Toyota itself this morning in Japan admitted, for example, that a brand new car, a 2010 Prius, has a braking problem that they knew about and didn't talk about. They quietly fixed in their assembly line, and so that some 2010 Priuses have this braking problem and some don't. And that reflects a general pattern that we found in our reporting, which is Toyota lots of times, just like any automaker, finds problems. The difference is Toyota quietly fixes them and doesn't tell anybody. And so there are cars out there that have problems they didn't talk about. For example, the Sienna minivan 1 year had a defect they detected. They quietly fixed and walked away, but they left 25,000 cars on the road with that problem and didn't do anything about it for 6 years. And that's a pattern that's kind of troubling. As to the size of Toyota, clearly there's an issue there. They for years gunned to be number one. They finally got it in 2008. But when you get really big, to do that, you have to make some sacrifices. And some people are saying, well, quality was what was sacrificed.
Interesting.
You had to cut costs. And when you cut costs, quality goes down.
All right. Ken Bensinger is a reporter at the L.A. Times. Jeffrey Leiker, what do you think? Is Toyota too big to succeed here?
Well, I still think these are specific issues. The Prius is a software glitch and a new piece of software. It's a less than a second delay. It happens when there's a bump in the road. These are still very specific technical issues. So I don't think they're too big to design and build good cars. I also,
although at 60 miles an hour, a second delay is a pretty significant distance.
It's not an insignificant thing. I'm just saying the mistake could be understood as one mistake and not the result of thousands of people making thousands of mistakes.
All right, Jeffrey Leiker is a professor at the University of Michigan's College of Engineering, co-author of The Toyota Way. We're talking about Toyota's problems this morning. We also heard from Ken Bensinger, a reporter at the L.A. Times, who's authored a series of investigative reports. Toyota moving forward, maybe not. At 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some stories we're following. Celeste?
President Obama told fellow Democrats yesterday to finish the job on health care. He said the GOP Senate win in Massachusetts shouldn't deter the party.
So I would just suggest to this caucus, if anybody's searching for a lesson from Massachusetts, I promise you the answer is not to do nothing.
Speaking of Massachusetts, Republican Scott Brown will be sworn in this afternoon as the state's newest senator, taking over for the late Ted Kennedy. And the president's comments on health care come as the government releases a new estimate on the costs. The report says government programs will pay for a little more than half of all health care in the U.S. by 2012. Moving on to Pakistan, we'll have a follow-up on yesterday's bombing of a girls' school near the Afghan border that killed three U.S. soldiers. Police now say the suicide bomber specifically targeted the Americans. That attack comes as NATO forces ramp up for an offensive in neighboring Afghanistan.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has rejected Iran's offer to swap three American hikers detained in Tehran for Iranians being held in the U.S., but she says Iran should still release those hikers.
They should do so on humanitarian grounds, since the detentions of our citizens is baseless.
Clinton called the allegations against the hikers completely unjust. Finally, expectant mothers are getting a new tool to keep themselves and their babies healthy. Pregnancy tips sent to their cell phones by text message, a free education program in the U.S. to use mobile phones. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Up next, conspiracy theories start flying after Goldman Sachs CEO leaves a cryptic voice message. Also, a look at what's going on in Pakistan.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're
listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
News Takeouts Now. Ibrahim Abdelmateen is in the studio along with Louise Story from our partner, the New York Times. But we begin in Islamabad, Pakistan. Our partner, the BBC's Mark Dummett, is there to report on two significant stories out of Pakistan. First, the Associated Press is now reporting that the Taliban's leader in Pakistan, Hakimullah Massoud, reportedly dead. No official on-the-record confirmation of that. But Mark Dummett, what do we make of this?
Well, if it is true, then this would be quite a major victory, really, for the U.S. And the Pakistani government, which is deeply opposed to this man, because ever since he's been in charge of the Pakistan Taliban, he took over in August last year. He was responsible. He was behind a wave of attacks on Pakistani cities, which killed hundreds of civilians. These reports suggest that he was killed by a U.S. drone strike in the middle of January. But it's got to be said, we haven't had anything official. The government here says that they simply don't know. They have heard these reports, but their agents on the ground can't confirm it. The Taliban have denied these reports. And of course, because of where he's reported to have been killed or where this strike happened, it's in the middle of this tribal belt. The government doesn't have a real presence there. We can't send people in to find out either. So basically, no one yet knows. But these reports do keep on coming out, and they are quite persistent.
Yeah, another drone attack, at least according to the report, in that remote area. Mark Dummett, what do we make this morning of the deaths of three American troops in apparently Pakistani territory near the Afghan border? That was reported yesterday as well.
Yeah, well, these they weren't combat troops. They were special forces attached to the Frontier Corps, the Pakistani force responsible for security in the tribal areas and along in the northwest frontier, the area close to Afghanistan. They were trainers. They were military trainers. And they were on their way to visit a school which had been previously destroyed by the Taliban, a girls' school, but which had since been rebuilt with funding from USAID. This poses several questions, the fact that they were killed. Firstly, how did the Taliban know that they were in this convoy on the way to the girls' school? How were they targeted? Or was it just a fluke? Was it just chance? I mean, and secondly, it raises all sorts of questions here in Pakistan about what the American forces are doing here, because it's no secret that there are U.S. military trainers here, but it's not widely advertised.
No, and it's a very, very sensitive issue indeed, and we'll watch
controversial.
The fallout from that report as well. Mark Dummett, BBC reporter in Islamabad, Pakistan. Thanks for that.
Let's move on to kind of a mystery, an enigma, with Louise Story, the finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein left a very cryptic message for his employees last week. What did it say?
So their voicemail boxes are lit up. The Goldman Sachs employees go, they answer, and there's Lloyd Blankfein saying, "Performance is the ultimate narrative." Now remember, this is coming at a very important time. It's bonus time. Right around then, all the Goldman Sachs employees found out their bonuses.
Right.
And everyone's wondering, what's his bonus going to be? What's Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman, what's his bonus going to be?
Gosh, well, I hope it's a really big one.
They posted record profits last year. So if performance is the ultimate narrative, that would mean he'd get a record bonus?
It could mean that. You know, he did get a record bonus in 2007. He got $68 million. And it's a bit hard. It's a bit hard in this environment to imagine something higher than that.
Yeah, it's true, think that performance is the ultimate narrative mean?
That's the question. That's the question. He'll have to file a Form 4. Mm. The company will have to file something called a Form 4 when they award his stock. And so everyone's on the Securities and Exchange Commission site looking for that Form 4. And I got to tell you, people are so interested, and this wait, because this is later than usual, is taking so long. It's starting to feel like the TMZ of Wall Street bonuses.
Yes.
You know, everyone
wants
to know, what's the number?
If it's a high number, he's going to be really, really depressed because it's going to be a PR problem.
Washington.
No, not another 100 million.
Oh,
no,
poor Lloyd.
Well, he kind of wins and he loses. He gets the cash, but, you know, also the hatred if it's too high.
I think he'll be able to afford the hatred.
Indeed.
We'll see. Affording the hatred. It's all about working in investment banking these days. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor, with our final takeout. And we've been profiling Super Bowl players in the Super Bowl 44 coming up this weekend. And it's time to look at those key players who, well, let's just go back to Super Bowl 38 against the Carolina Panthers. Adam Vinatieri of the New England Patriots had to kick a 41-yard field goal.
Snap. Well done. Kick up. Kick is on the way.
Happy ending for Vinatieri, but what about Scott Norwood of the Buffalo Bills in Super Bowl 25, a 47-yard attempt?
Spot in the air, got the distance.
So looking ahead, Ibrahim, who's the kicker that's going to have the most pressure this weekend?
You know, I just reacting to the Scott Norwood miss, that was one of the worst moments of my young life. that was a deep stain on my heart. I missed those Buffalo Bills. But this week, we're talking about Garrett Hartley, who's the kicker for the New Orleans Saints.
Right.
They wouldn't be there without Garrett Hartley.
Exactly.
He kicked the game-winning field goal against the Vikings in the NFC Championship game. So he's already stepped into Saints lore. He's a rookie, and it couldn't get any more exciting for him. He had a dream the night before the game that he was going to kick the winning kick. So this is his meteoric rise. He will be known as a legend and a hero if he can kick the game-winning kick against the Colts in the Super Bowl. On the other side, Matt Stover, who took the place of Adam Vinatieri, who now kicks for the Colts,
right,
was injured. Stover came in week five, and he took over. He's the oldest. He'll be the oldest man to ever play in the Super Bowl.
Wow.
42 years old with 11 days.
So the oldest man ever to play the Super Bowl is kicking for the Colts, and the rookie kicks for the Saints. There's another great story.
So the question is, do you want, if it's the end of the game and it's down to one kick, do you want the guy who's got the experience and the wisdom, or do you want the energy and the exuberance?
The guy with the luck.
There you go.
Abdelmateen, that's a great question. Takeaway Sports Contributor. Coming up, retired service members like Senator John McCain say repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell would have negative consequences. We're going to talk to somebody with a different view. And we're looking for your platform. Found a third party and give us a platform at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the debate over repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Yesterday, we heard one point of view saying it could cause an earthquake in the culture of the military. Today, we hear another point of view in just a few moments. First, here's some of the stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Another day, another crisis for Toyota. Now the company says there were design problems with the anti-lock brake system in the new Prius, which went on sale last year. As for the recall, yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said investigators are looking at more than just gas pedals in Toyotas.
We've had some complaints about the electronics in these automobiles, and that's the reason that we're going to look into it.
Toyota expects costs and lost sales from its largest ever recall to total $2 billion. That number will be cushioned a little bit by the news earlier this morning that Toyota posted a $1.7 billion profit last quarter. A new report shows healthcare spending grew to a record 17% of the U.S. economy last year. That's the biggest one-year jump on record. Overall, almost $2.5 trillion federal dollars were spent on health care last year, and the report says in 2 years the government will pay for more than half of all health care in the United States.
And that's without the health care reform proposed by President Obama. He tried to rally the rank and file at a Democratic retreat yesterday, telling them to, quote, finish the job on health care reform. In Haiti, the 10 U.S. missionaries facing charges for trying to leave the country with undocumented children will appear before a prosecutor, who will then decide whether to press charges. The Reverend Jean Sanvie, the pastor who helped the group gather kids, says parents were willing to part with their children to give them a better life.
A woman came up to me and said, it's only me with 5 children. She said, I'm hopeless and I'm homeless.
Parents say they were promised education and housing for their children. Here in New York City, construction at the World Trade Center site has hit a milestone. Structural steel is now in place up to the 20th floor, 200 feet high. The 104-story Freedom Tower is scheduled to be completed in 2013. Take a look at the markets this morning. Asian and European markets are down, and futures for Wall Street trading are way down. The Dow gets underway at 10,270. The S&P opens at 1,097, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,190. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, President Obama has made it clear that he would like to have Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed, and Admiral Mike Mullen and Defense Secretary Robert Gates are investigating the effects of that. Now, it's a controversial military policy that says gay service members may serve but should not reveal their sexual orientation. So how much would it change in the military if this law were repealed? We're joined now by Michael Hyacinth. He served in the Navy from 1997 to 2005 in a construction battalion, reaching the rank of E5. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Yesterday on the show, we had a retired Colonel David F. Beatty, who is against repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And here's what he had to say.
What most people don't understand is that the military is a pretty cloistered sort of community. Kind of like a gated community. It's a lot different than the rest of society. It's much more culturally conservative.
So that's the opinion of a 30-year Army veteran. What do you think? Is the military a lot more conservative than the society at large?
Well, I have to totally disagree with him. I think the military, in regards to the UCMJ, is probably the most diverse community that we actually have in America. So regardless of how he thinks, I think it's totally...
The UCMJ being?
The Uniform Code of Military Justice, which basically guides and governs the structure of the military.
Now he disagreed with any comparison between the racial diversity in the military and diversity which includes sexual orientation. He said those are two completely separate things.
Well, you know, it's funny that we're having this debate now with the this being Black History Month. I totally disagree. I think, you know, for American citizens and taxpayers to send, citizens to Iraq to possibly, die for their freedoms and the liberties that we back here enjoy, and then not have them freely express themselves, I think it's un-American. I think it's something which is long overdue. So I commend Admiral Mullen on his stance on this policy.
Well, I want to play you a clip that we got actually from a listener. This is Anthony from Connecticut. He also served in the military.
When I was in boot camp, they separated the males and the females and put them in their own barracks to avoid any complications of people as young as we were in our sexual prime. How do we train people who are openly gay in the military? At what expense?
What's your reaction to that, that they acknowledge the sexual nature of the attraction between men and women, but if you throw gays into that mix, that it throws out the window?
Well, I think it's much more than just, the two different sexes. I think, women have certain needs and men have certain needs, so it's only fitting to actually to fit them in certain, locations. But, it's a 21st century, military, whereas, we don't share, bathrooms anymore. I mean, basically in Iraq now you have, a particular communal that you would use by yourself. So it's, for them to make that argument, it's baseless.
You know, it's curious to me that there are so many scandals associated with the military that have to do with kind of heterosexuality out of control. Tailhook, for instance, in the Air Force. Some of the disturbing pictures from the Abu Ghraib were sort of heterosexuality gone horribly wrong. I'm just curious as to why this feels like such a hot button to certain people in the military.
Well, I believe it's a social. It's more of a social issue. You look at the ranking members within the military, the structure that they've come from, particularly, John McCain. This was a particular gentleman who was, during the 2006 campaign, he said he would listen to the troops. Now, because I guess he's, it's fitting to his party, he's repealing exactly what he said on it. So I think it's a structure. It's a mental ignorance, to be quite honest with you.
Did you serve with soldiers during your time in the Navy? Did you serve with people that you knew were gay, even though it wasn't open?
Absolutely. I mean, it's only, you can basically see it. It's right there, but it's a difficult thing, psychologically as well, for these guys to actually, do 8 to 10 month deployments in harm's way and then have to come back home on a regular military base and hide who they really are. So psychologically, I think we're definitely, we're doing an injustice and in service to these members.
But did you have people in your company maybe that felt awkward about it, that were troubled over the inclusion of gay servicemen and women?
Well, yes, I think it's and I think that's probably going to be the biggest issue is to reintegrate the mental capacity of actually allowing these young soldiers to accept the fact that they are men and women, who proudly serve their country, that are bisexual. I think that's probably going to be the biggest obstacle.
I want to play you another clip from retired Colonel David F. Beatty, in which he kind of talks about a slippery slope.
We think, I mean, some of us believe, that the next step will be a move to extend full rights to same-sex couples. The military provides an easy place to make that happen, and what many of us think may be the consequence of that is the introduction of same-sex couples in military family housing areas.
So do you also have worries about how complicated this could become? Should they repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that it will end up having a domino effect?
Well, I do believe it's going to have its logistical issues. I think, you know, you look at a ban which has been in existence for over close to two decades. It's going to have some issues. But I think it's something that the United States military, you know, have the leadership capabilities to actually put in structure, a method that benefits, you know, every American soldier. Like I said, the UCMJ in particular. I mean, you read the UCMJ, it prevents any inappropriate, you know, misconduct.
But we have had issues between men and female service members serving overseas.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, we're at the end of the day, we're all human, you know, individuals, and we, you know, no one is perfect. But I do believe that if any nation can create a structure where Americans can serve freely and proudly together, I do believe it is the United States military.
Michael Hyacinth served in the Navy from 1997 to 2005. He was the founder of Urban Liberty, an e-commerce marketing company that caters to the military. Coming up, Google, how do we use it and how has it changed us? That's coming up in our tech segment.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. You know, the U.S. Marshals Service has a message for everyone. You can run, but you can't hide, even if you run south of the border. Recently, there have been some very successful campaigns to capture fugitives who are hiding out in Mexico more than ever before. Why now? Joining us is Jose Valenzuela. He's a deputy U.S. Marshal assigned to the Mexico Investigative Liaison Unit in Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, Jose.
Good morning.
You know, it's difficult to talk about numbers in great detail over the radio, but I wanted to just give these particular statistics. In 1999, the United States caught 14 fugitives in Mexico and returned them to the United States. Last year, they caught almost 100. Why is there this huge increase?
Well, the cooperation between Mexican authorities and the United States Marshal Service, it's been huge since 1999. And then we have criminal investigators, deputy U.S. Marshals assigned in Mexico City. And the work we've done, it's amazing. It's very cooperative, very, how would you say, it's just the work we've been doing down there, it's great. The cooperation between them and us, it's just been phenomenal.
Well, what has made that change? There were complaints always through the 1980s and 1990s about the lack of cooperation, about the lack of efficiency in coordinating any kind of efforts with Mexican authorities.
I think it's the government, their government and our government, too. And also, it's the fact that we're looking for serious offenders, murderers, rapists, and they don't want those people in their country, and we don't want them in our country. And that's what's been, I think, is the main factor, is that we don't want rapists and murderers running around our country or their country. And that's why I believe they've been helping us.
How hard is it to track someone once they cross the border? What are the specific challenges that occur that may not happen when you're trying to find them in the United States?
Well, I think the hardest thing is the information we get. And the towns down there are so it's very difficult to track down these guys down in Mexico because there's not obviously the technology is not how would you say it's not there, so we have to come up with different ways of tracking these guys.
You recently worked on a successful case, where Mexican authorities helped you track down three fugitives who were accused of child molestation. Can you tell me how that happened?
They walked away from the shelter here in Phoenix, in Mesa, I think it was, and they and you know we they contacted me and then began the investigation with interviews, and I can't go into specific details on how we did some of our techniques there, but we were able to track him down in Chihuahua, and I was in constant communication with the Chihuahua State Police and with our other task force members. We were able to get information of where they were at. And I would relay that information to the Chihuahua State Police, and they were very helpful in tracking these guys down, with the information we were developing here in the United States.
Jose Valenzuela is the Deputy U.S. Marshal assigned to the Mexico Investigative Liaison Unit, trying to make sure he doesn't give out too much information. But your message is you can't hide south of the border, right? He's joined us from Phoenix.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up in our tech segment, a cartoon, a cartoonist, Google, and the brain, all wrapped up into one discussion of what Google does to our brains when we decide to do search commands. Roz Chast and a brain scientist join us in just a moment. Right now, here's a check on leading stories. They're coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. Toyota leads off the headlines. First, the Washington Post says federal regulators have uncovered evidence that some Toyota cars have been having gas pedal problems as far back as 2007. Federal regulators have already said those problems may be more complicated than simply mechanical, as the company believes. Safety researcher Sean Kane says Toyota's sudden acceleration problem strikes him as an electronic issue, not a mechanical one.
In fact, I would even go out and to say that there is no other explanation for many of the complaints that we have seen other than electronics.
Out of Tokyo this morning, the company announced design problems with some anti-lock brake systems in the 2010 Prius. In other tech news, the National Security Agency is expected to help Google analyze a major hacker attack that originated in China. They'll work together to find a way to defend Google from future attacks.
Now our daily look at international business. And China has rebuked President Obama after comments that the president made yesterday, alleging that the country artificially devalues its currency, giving it an unfair exchange rate against the dollar. Here's what the president said.
If we have established agreements in which both sides are supposed to open up their markets, we do so, and then the other side is imposing a whole set of non-tariff barriers in place, that's a problem, and it has to be squarely confronted.
To explain, BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg joins us from Shanghai. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
And what is China's reaction to these comments from President Obama?
Well, the reaction came from the foreign ministry spokesman, who insisted that the Chinese currency was valued at the correct level. He also said that wrongful accusations and pressure would not help solve the problems, the trade spats between the two countries.
Is there proof that China is devaluing its currency on purpose?
Well, there's certainly a lot of complaints about it from economists both in America and, of course, in Europe as well. The complaint goes like this, really. Basically, the Chinese economy has recovered earlier and stronger than almost anywhere else in the world, and yet the yuan is pegged to the dollar, a weakening currency. So what the economists say is, how can it be that when your economy is stronger than anyone else's, your currency is weaker? It doesn't make sense.
Okay, well, President Obama says this has to be squarely confronted. We'll see what that means in the months ahead. Thanks so much, BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg. Finally, a new report says only 8% of online teens have embraced Twitter, and it hasn't caught on in the same way as Facebook and text messaging. Experts say teens want to interact with their friends, not broadcast their conversations to the world. Yeah. Those are some of the news.
It's a no-brainer.
Absolutely. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Our tech segment this Thursday involves a cartoon. Yes, it's an old technology, but the ideas in Roz Chast's cartoon in The New Yorker a few weeks back, envisioning a Google magazine, it seems to me says it all about what Google has done to all of us. It's my pleasure to welcome Roz Chast to The Takeaway. Good morning, Roz.
Yes, good morning.
New Yorker cartoonist. You've been doing that for how long?
About 30 years.
Wow. And Gary Small also joins us. He's the author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. That's a very scary title, Gary Small.
Well, I don't mean to make you frightened,
maybe make you think a little bit offline?
Well, certainly this cartoon that you came up with a few weeks back, Roz Chass, made me think. And I urge people to go to our website where they can actually find it. But I'll just sort of sketch it out verbally here. Google Magazine, all right, that's what it says across the top. And the articles are descriptions of what we might call searches on Google. Instead of, you know, 10 ways to make your husband happy, the articles are Capital Nebraska, what? Paella, how to quick? And I'll give you one more, bioethyl merman. I have to say, Roz Chast, I looked at this cartoon, burst out laughing, and said to myself, this totally says it all about what Google has done to my mind, my language, my ability to write. Where'd you come up with this?
I think I spend probably more time online than I should, and it's kind of fun to look stuff up on Google. Sometimes I just like put words together at random and see what comes up, and it's amazing because something almost always does come up. I almost feel sort of shocked when nothing comes up.
And I can look at these, even though they're nonsense in grammatical terms, and know exactly what you're headed for. You want to know what the capital of Nebraska is, so you type in capital Nebraska what. You want to know how to make a quick paella, which is actually quite difficult, and you type in paella how to quick. Gary Small, what's going on in Roz Chast's brain as she's typing these things in, or mine for that matter?
Well, your brain is very active when you're searching online. When I started writing iBrain, I was struck by the fact no one had looked at the brain when it's searching. So we decided to recruit some people who had never been online. And that was probably the hardest part of the study. We couldn't recruit them online, of course. But by word of mouth, we found about a dozen people who had never searched online. And we found that their brains were not as active as those who searched online. But the good news is, after just a week of online searching, there was incredible increase in activity in the front part of the brain, the thinking brain, decision-making brain, and short-term memory brain.
But that seems to contradict the notion that we're all going to end up talking like this Google magazine, where we say, Capital Nebraska, what? We can't really complete a sentence because we'll just sort of Google it, and that we're really relying on Google to do what would have normally taken maybe an afternoon at the library.
The technology is complex, and the brain is complex as well. And so we're seeing a burst of activity once the brain figures out a strategy on how to search. But with time, it becomes routine, and we see less activity, and our brains become more efficient. So just because there's activity doesn't mean we're getting any smarter. And in a way, we're developing a staccato quality of thought where we jump from idea to idea, just the way we jump from website to website.
Right. Gary Small, author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Roz Chast, New Yorker cartoonist. So jumping from thing to thing is actually the perfect description of how the mind of a cartoonist must work, I would think.
Yeah, I think that's pretty true. Attention span of about, you know, a fraction of a second. And, you know, but I also like on the Google search where it says the search, how long it took, and it's 0.00013 seconds. That just kills me. I just love that. But I don't know. I think I'm less optimistic about it making us smarter. I think eventually we're not going to have to remember anything, and we'll just all have these little Google-like chips in our heads. And anytime you want to know anything, you know, how do I make a tuna sandwich? You know, you'll just kind of like Google inside of your head, you know, tuna sandwich, how make, and, you know, you won't have to remember how to do it.
That's the way we'll all talk. Like we're all visitors to another planet. Gary Small, react. Cheer us up here, really.
It's all good. Don't worry. But you know, what's happening is we're all developing external hard drives as accessories to our biological brains. So, yes, in the future, we may be Googling outside our brains. But how is that different from what goes on now? If we want to search our memory stores, we kind of do an internal Google to find the information. All this is going to do is really accelerate our brain power.
Roz Chast, has Google or the proliferation of digital technology changed the way you work?
Not really. I mean, I still, you know, it changes the subject matter, but for me, it's still about, you know, what's funny and then doing a cartoon about it.
Okay, well, let's make Roz a little uncomfortable on the way out. Gary Small, you're a fan, right?
Oh, big fan.
And there's,
I'm not worthy.
There's nothing about the technology that's going to change Roz Chast's ability to communicate with us, right?
I don't think so. If anything, we want to think about the upside of the technology, that it allows us to communicate with a much wider audience much more quickly. So anything that's human, anything that's artistic, anything that we enjoy today, the technology has a capacity to make it bigger and better if we don't overdo it.
Including cartoons. That concludes the squirmy portion of the program, Roz Chast. Thanks so much for being with us. Cartoonist for The New Yorker, has been for decades. She joined us from Connecticut. And Gary Small, author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Google him. You'll find him. Thanks, Gary.
Later today, the Tea Party Convention is kicking off in Nashville in hopes of starting a third political party.
And as a Jersey girl, if I'm going to start a political party, of course it's got to be the Jersey Shore Party. I think we need to have crazy nicknames, a lot of tan, and of course, big, big, big hair.
That was Takeaway Culture contributor Mary Elizabeth Williams.
Jersey,
what do you
Shore
think?
Party.
What would you call your party, and what would be its platform? 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
If you missed anything, you know where to go, thetakeaway.org or iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.